power to which people? Voters take to the streets in Tehran to protest and support the weekend outcome in the Iranian election. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad appears victorious. Some in Iran appear to doubt the legitimacy of the election. A misread by the West once again in Iran. Obama and the signals from Tehran on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, June 15th. Iran is the big story this morning. I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up this hour, we'll have full coverage of the reaction to the election in Tehran. We've also got the takeaway agenda. Our kickoff conversation begins with Iran and takes us through the Arab-Israeli peace process. More news on that over the weekend. Plus, we'll examine an alarming story that's shocking animal lovers everywhere, but it's been particularly brutal in Miami. All this and much more ahead. First, we have your latest headlines. In the headlines, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is launching an investigation into fraud claims in last week's presidential election. It's a shift for him. He previously praised the results. Riots broke out this weekend after election officials declared incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad the winner. Ahmadinejad says the vote was fair. His main rival, Mir Hussein Mousavi, wants the results annulled. News is just out this morning that President Ahmadinejad is delaying a planned visit to Russia. President Obama hits the road to sell his health care plan today. He'll speak to the American Medical Association, a lobbying group for some doctors. The AMA has criticized White House interest in a government-run insurance program. And later today, the president meets with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. That meeting comes in advance of the Group of Eight summit, which will be hosted by Italy in July. And staying with news from the White House, President Obama calls a new speech by Israel's prime minister over the weekend an important step forward. Benjamin Netanyahu endorsed a Palestinian state for the first time yesterday, but he also refused to heed a U.S. call to immediately freeze settlement construction. Palestinian officials are so far very cool to the speech, citing preconditions Netanyahu placed on forming a state. Femi Oke is here in the studio. What else is in the headlines, Femi?
Hello there. American and NATO troops now have a new commander. General Stanley McChrystal took charge a few hours ago. He wants to break a recent trend of rising civilian casualties.
The Afghan people are at the center of our mission. In reality, they are our mission. We must protect them from violence, whatever its nature. We must respect their religion and their traditions.
McChrystal takes control as the American troop presence is rising substantially. In sports, basketball has a new champion this morning. The LA Lakers beat the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals last night, 99-86. They won the championship series 4-1. Coach Phil Jackson won a record 10th NBA title. And we'll have more on this a little bit later from our takeaway sports mastermind, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And the game was in Orlando, but some fans back home in LA got a little bit rowdy. Police arrested a couple dozen partiers after some threw rocks and lit bonfires.
John. People throwing rocks in LA, that's news. Thank you, Femi. Yeah. The Dow begins at 87.99. The S&P starts trading at 9.46. Everybody knows that if you're dying, that's covered by your insurance plan,
right. Probably.
But in the healthcare reform debate, what should be covered? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Maybe something to help you live better?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry. The agenda is being set from Tehran this morning.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on?
We begin the week with a discussion of Tehran with our friend Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times, here in the studio. Marcus, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
Looking at what's been going on, Ahmadinejad, the incumbent, was named president. It was suggested that it's a landslide, 63% of the vote going to Ahmadinejad. The questions of legitimacy of this result are certainly being asked by people on the streets of Tehran. You heard the sounds a moment ago of demonstrations yesterday. There are even more today. How seriously does the Obama administration have to take these questions of legitimacy, or does the administration just back away?
Well, it's a tough position they're in. The problem with Iran has always been the fact that in this country you have two issues. You have a divided polity, and on one side you have conservatives who are worried about the U.S. and the loss of Iranian power relative to the region and want to assert Iran's power. On the other hand, you have moderates who actually are incredibly modern. You have, in many ways, the Islamic country that is in many ways has the most intelligent, developed middle class and class of intellectuals in the region. So you have these two different Irans that exist side by side, and right now what the administration is watching is the two clash on the streets of Tehran and throughout the country. As you have a youth movement that supports the opposition that could, in fact, become an underground that even if the Ayatollahs come out and say that they support this election result of Ahmadinejad coming back to office, could create a kind of underground, underlying problem for years to come for this regime.
Well, there's an interesting issue there. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has suggested that they're going to investigate fraud claims. He's backed away from the sort of blanket congratulatory message over the weekend to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. That seems to be a cautionary approach on the part of the Supreme Leader.
It is a huge surprise, and because no one really expected that result. They expected that once they had come out, they were not going to reverse position. And the fact that they have is that they understand the threat posed by their own polity and their own youth, in effect. So this is the administration's challenge is, as the U.S., how do you ride this tiger? Do you encourage this dissent, maybe even privately, maybe covertly, rather than openly.
Except that's a dangerous game. I mean, you're stepping
game.
Into a regime change policy. The Obama administration
regime change usually implies change from the United States, brought often with our own military might. This is quite different, and this would be a longer term engagement if the administration were to choose to take that route.
Stakes are very, very high. Joining us now, BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus from London. Jonathan, good morning. And I gather the BBC is having some difficulty getting information out of Tehran in the wake of this election.
Well, there's been an awful lot of interference with both communications signals and indeed our radio and online signals. Getting in touch with our correspondents there, often by satellite telephone, to some extent by email. But it's a very confused, a very volatile picture still. And we understand now that President Ahmadinejad, I suppose we still must call him that, is not going to be heading to the Shanghai Cooperation Council meeting in Russia, as was expected. It looks now as though he's going to be staying at home. So that's an indication, perhaps, of the dynamics that are going on.
Jonathan, at the very least, aftermath has disrupted events in Tehran. We spoke a moment ago about Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei suggesting there will be an investigation of fraud charges. You've suggested that Ahmadinejad has canceled a trip to Russia. What is the importance of seeing Mir Hussein Mousavi, the opposition candidate, whose whereabouts I believe are unknown at this hour, seeing him in public? Is the international community going to push for that?
I think there's going to be a great deal of caution. I mean, I think one has to remember, looking at this, there are probably many, many forces at work in terms of the popular upsurge of feelings. I mean, clearly, some don't like the regime as a whole and would like to replace it with something very different. You have to remember, though, that all of the candidates in the election were people who were vetted by the existing regime. They were all elements within the really rather conservative Islamic ruling elite of the country. So I think one has to be cautious. I mean, to see this simply as a sort of an Iranian velvet revolution, or comparisons with Tiananmen Square and so on, I think of all those comparisons one should be very, very cautious about using. Something absolutely fascinating and dramatic is happening, but quite where it's going to lead shouldn't be coloured if you like, by these sorts of international comparisons.
One last question on Iran, Jonathan. The Bush administration, and it seems the U.S. policymakers fairly consistently responded to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad by confronting him every step of the way, and it seemed to me the net effect of that was to inflate his power within Iran and within the international community. Do you think it's time to depart from that, perhaps step away from Ahmadinejad, let him sort out his domestic agenda and allow the sort of tit-for-tat confrontation to go by the wayside?
Well, look, it's clear the American administration has been waiting until the aftermath of these elections to really roll out this new policy of engagement with Tehran. Clearly, the uncertainties now inside Iran mean that that is going to be delayed. Clearly, Washington cannot choose who it deals with in Tehran. I think what's going to be crucial, all the signals coming from the Obama administration suggest that when the situation clarifies there, this engagement policy will continue. I think there is little choice but to do that. The question is, what sort of engagement is the Obama administration really intending? Is this going to be some sort of comprehensive approach, what some have called a grand bargain, that would touch on all of the outstanding issues between Washington and Tehran? Or would it be something rather more limited, step by step, something that perhaps conservative voices in Tehran would simply dismiss as the same old rhetoric, the same old approach? So I think the ball to some extent will be in President Obama's court, but he cannot serve that ball, if you want to extend the
there
analogy,
you go. There
the metaphor,
you go, Jonathan.
Until obviously the situation in Tehran becomes clearer.
A complicated ball, or is it a badminton? It's a complicated serve, no matter what. Talk about engagement, Marcus Mabry. Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, gave an important policy speech over the weekend. The Obama administration has already called it a step forward, but is it?
Yes, it is. Certainly when it comes from Netanyahu, who is a conservative Israeli, and the fact that he has acknowledged the need for a two-state solution, as it were, a Palestinian state, that's progress for those who want to see that roadmap advance toward a two-state solution in the Middle East.
The Palestinians really criticized the fact that it seemed as though he was inflexible on Jerusalem, inflexible on a right of return for Palestinians, inflexible even about talking about those issues, which is at odds with the whole Arab nexus.
It is, but the fact is he's not the first Israeli politician to come out on that side. Even centrist politicians and some leftist politicians have said the same things about right of return in Jerusalem being indivisible as the Israeli capital. But what's interesting here is going to be the settlement issue. He said that it's fine for them to construct settlements. Again, not unheard of amongst his predecessors. It's going to be interesting to see how the administration comes out and walks this delicate line between encouraging him, because it is, when it comes to Netanyahu, these are steps forward. And if any Israeli leader is going to be able to actually advance this goal of a two-state solution in the end, it would have to be a kind of Nixon to China moment. And Netanyahu could be the leader to do that. His predecessors certainly weren't in that position. The administration's position is going to be, how do you encourage that and at the same time let the world, the Palestinians, our European allies who support often the Palestinian cause, realize that the U.S. is still an honest broker and can actually work on both sides of the street and help bring these two sides together. I think this was only an opening gambit. I don't think this is at all a final bid, and you can't argue that the things that Netanyahu called for instance, a state that was unable to make any alliances with any foreign country would have be completely demilitarized, and have the United States in effect be the security barrier between the two sides.
You're referring to Netanyahu possible. Calling for a totally demilitarized Palestinian state, which isn't right. All right, Jonathan, Marcus, the wild card here may be George Mitchell, the U.S. Middle East envoy in Syria. Can Damascus create some momentum here from the side?
Well, of course, what's interesting is that Mr. Netanyahu in his speech only referred to Syria, I think, once. He didn't mention the Golan Heights specifically. Some Israeli analysts are seeing that as a bid, if you like, a gambit, a signal to both Damascus and Washington that perhaps Mr. Netanyahu might be more willing to try and engage on the Syrian track. I think the Mitchell visit to Syria over the weekend is interesting. We obviously haven't got a particularly detailed readout of what was said there, One of the things, of course, the Americans want from the Syrians is to try and bring pressure to bear on Hamas in the Gaza Strip to try and push towards Palestinian unity, because I think it's quite clear that Syria, without a Palestinian unity government, there isn't going to be much progress.
And Syria has leverage there. Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, thanks as always. Marcus Mabry, this morning I come in, I say, we've got to have time to talk about health care. I think it's fairly clear if we can't do it, it's going to be hard for the Obama administration to get to it this week. We got to go, Marcus. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Getting to health care. It's the Obama administration's challenge and ours here on The Agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. You know, we all know in the real world of healthcare that there's a lot that doesn't get paid for. If you were going to design the perfect health insurance plan for yourself, what would you cover?
This is Marty from Brentwood, New Hampshire. Dental care should be part of the discussion. An essential part of healthcare. Infections in teeth spread to the body, etc., and it can cost thousands of dollars.
How about a gym membership? Weight reduction, mental health care, coverage for your whole family. Tell us what needs coverage in your life at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we're going to pause now for all the international news and the healthcare debate, which we're going to continue with in just a moment. But we're going to pause for a very local story that really shows how vulnerable all of us are in our own neighborhoods and communities if the right set of conditions lines up to terrify people. Listen to these people talking about an event that transpired over the past few weeks in Miami.
It's been a nightmare here for the past week. We've been pretty much on lockdown. My husband and I have not been sleeping. We've been up all night sitting out in front of the house, taking watch. It's very fearful.
That's Stacy Dorr. She lives near two of the killings in her neighborhood occurred in a string of crimes targeting cats in her neighborhood. She, of course, is a cat owner herself, along with her 12-year-old daughter.
When they say a serial cat killer that could escalate to children and women, you never in your wildest dreams could imagine that something like this could be happening in your community.
Well, over the weekend, Tyler Hayes Weinman, an 18-year-old, was arrested and charged with 19 counts of animal cruelty, 19 counts of improperly disposing of an animal body, and 4 counts of burglary. Miami Herald reporter Jose Palieri is in the studios of WLRN, public radio station in Miami, Florida. Jose, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You know, this is a bizarre story, and I don't want to overemphasize the importance of, cats dying when so many other things are happening. But nevertheless, this really is a portrait of a neighborhood taken hostage by a criminal who has apparently targeted some of the most helpless creatures in any residential neighborhood.
What's interesting here is that these two neighborhoods, Palmetto Bay and Cutler Bay, which are located just south of Miami, they've been absolutely terrorized since early May when dozens of cats began popping up with mutated bodies on people's lawns. No one knew what was going on at first, but 1 or 2 weeks after it started, police started saying that there was this serial cat killer or cat killers they were searching for.
And what was the mystery here? I mean, the neighborhood really was terrified in a very, very visible way, and police had to act. What sorts of tactics did they use?
Well, they've kept a lot. They've kept a lot of it under wraps, but they kept several detectives listening to movements on MySpace, Facebook, YouTube, taking in every tip they could from the community, and there were hundreds. It took weeks, but about 3 weeks ago, they began to do some surveillance on this person, Tyler Hayes Weinman. He's an 18-year-old in that quiet community, lives with his mother. According to police, there were postings he made on these websites that led them to him.
Now, how important do the police consider a crime like this, given that it does have such harrowing implications for people and children who hear about this sort of thing? And you could hear in the voice of Stacy there, you know, she viewed it as terrorism.
Right. I mean, from what I've gathered in recent weeks, a crime like this, animal cruelty in Florida, it tends to go under the radar. One count, maybe two counts. But what we're dealing with here are 19 counts. So these were 19 cats that were found dead on their owner's lawns. Their bodies mutilated, and they were killed between 6 p.m. and 5 a.m. Cops didn't know what was going on. These charges have stacked up, and the public outcry has been tremendous. So what this kid specifically is facing is pretty serious, because the police are stacking up charges not only of animal cruelty but burglary. They seem to be grasping for whatever they can charge him with.
Do the police think that they've solved the mystery here? And what is the connection, if any, between this kind of brutality against animals and strings of brutality against humans?
That's a good question. The connection, according to several studies I've seen, most people tend to think that a person who would harm animals will somehow graduate. I think that's the term. They'd graduate to humans. Although several of the psychiatric and psychological studies I've seen actually say that they don't necessarily graduate to humans, but that these people tend to have a very violent past overall.
I see. And do the police think that they've solved the mystery here, that this
they
would
do.
Be the only suspect?
That was the tone they had yesterday. The tone they had yesterday was one of closure. When commissioners and police majors spoke, they spoke of, you know, this finally being an end to the reign of terror that had captured these two towns.
And listen to a 17-year-old who goes to Miami Palmetto Senior High who reacted to the arrest.
It was really, really shocking that he went to Palmetto. He was a popular kid, you know. He knew a lot of people. It's just kind of makes me wonder what would make someone like that do such a horrible thing to animals.
Again, it's just an allegation at this point. The young man has been arrested, but you can hear in the voices of those high school students the visibility of this crime.
I'm glad you note that it is just an accusation right now, because police are alleging that this is the person behind this. But it's important to note, I mean, all the psychiatrists I spoke to before this happened yesterday, this arrest, they were expecting a quiet individual who's very reserved, drawn away from society, and who police ended up arresting was a very popular kid at school who was a swim gym counselor.
Jose Pagliari, reporter at the Miami Herald, following this tragic story of a cat serial killer in two Miami neighborhoods. He joined us from the studios of public radio station WLRN in Miami, Florida. And now Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thank you very much. President Obama is expected to tell members of the AMA today that healthcare overhaul can't wait. It could be a tough crowd he faces in Chicago. The group of doctors is opposed to a public alternative to private insurance. It doesn't want the government involved in medical decisions. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that a separate Palestinian state would have to disarm completely, a condition that's being rejected by many Palestinian leaders. Here's the senior Palestinian official negotiator, Saeb Erekat.
He is not with the two-state solution. He is not going to stop settlements, including natural growth. So we have attempts to move a peace process which was moving like a turtle in the region. Now Netanyahu tonight flipped it on its back.
However, the idea of a demilitarized state won support from conservatives who've historically been called to the idea of Palestinian independence. In Pakistan, the governor of the country's northwest frontier province says that the army is planning to launch a full-scale offensive against the top Taliban commander in the tribal area bordering Afghanistan. Now, sometimes it can be tough to get rid of a hangover. That goes for either a real one or one that's dramatized. And the film comedy The Hangover hauled in $33.4 million to remain number one at the box office for the second consecutive weekend. That's a look at your news.
The hangover won't quit. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. How does it go in healthcare? You pay to stay healthy. They pay when you get sick. If you were designing the perfect health insurance plan for yourself, what would be covered? Kathleen in Mendham, New Jersey says, I would like to see occupational therapy and sensory integration therapy covered for my son who has Asperger's syndrome. For myself, I'd love an emphasis on prevention, coverage of yoga, massage, and exercise. How else can healthcare be perfect in America?
Hello, my name is Terry, and I'm from New York. I think that 50 pharmacists should prescribe. I think that pharmacists have a great knowledge of drugs, and they also know what drugs are supposed to be on the drug list your insurance company covers. They can also prescribe cheaper medications for you.
Tell us what needs coverage in your life. How would you control costs at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Oh, I think it's fair to say that the NBA Finals ended in a business-like manner last night.
There's the final seconds. As the buzzer sounds, it's official. The Lakers are NBA champions once again. L.A. wins the 2009 NBA title.
It's official. The L.A. Lakers are NBA champions once again.
Business-like. It was a 3-1 advantage that the Lakers have, but they put the Orlando Magic away. If you're a Lakers fan, you know why they're celebrating. It's the team's 15th title, a record-setting title win for coach Phil Jackson. Takeaway contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen joins us. You watched the finals all the way through. The Magic just couldn't get it done. They looked so intimidated last night by the Lakers.
I think you have to wonder why Stan Van Gundy didn't go with Rafer Alston throughout the entire finals, and he went with Jameer Nelson, who was hurt for most of the season. And I think he ruined the chemistry, and I think that's what you saw. You saw a team that didn't really have quite the same chemistry that they had coming in.
Powerful team, the Orlando Magic, but if the chemistry is upset, clearly they were exploited. Their weaknesses were exploited by the Lakers, and there was nothing they could do about Kobe Bryant last night.
At all. Kobe Bryant had a shot where he went across the lane. He started on the right-hand side, was going to the left across the lane, and he jumped up, and he kind of like put the ball in his right hand, switched it to his left, and drifted to the left, and then shot it as he was going to the ground on, guess who? Dwight Howard.
Now, how significant is this for Kobe, winning a title without Shaquille O'Neal on the court with him?
He said in the post-game interview, he said that it was like Chinese torture every time he heard about Shaq and that whole thing about him not winning without Shaq. So I think for him, that little ugly underbite that he kept doing, that was probably the most disgusting thing I've seen an NBA player do, was probably all about that. And then hopefully that'll fade away into the background.
But I love this collaboration with Pau Gasol, the center there. You could see Kobe and Gasol. They had a really interesting kind of connection there on the court. And there were other sort of team connections as well with Kobe.
Well, Gasol said the other day, Kobe called him at 3 o'clock in the morning. Kobe's known for being a little bit overzealous and a little bit annoying. And Gasol was, and they asked him about him calling him at 3 o'clock in the morning. Gasol was like, well, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a little early. But on the court, they played like, a classic duo of all time. Gasol is they do the pick and roll, and he's money from the corners.
Yeah, but Ibrahim, if you're the center for the Los Angeles Lakers, you take a call from Kobe Bryant at 3 in the morning, correct?
Yeah. It's true.
Phil Jackson wins now 10 titles, breaking Red Auerbach's record. What's the significance of that for Jackson?
Well, now he can chomp on a big fat cigar. And I'm sure he can't do it in inside, because back in the day you could do it inside. But I think it's amazing, and it's an incredible feat. He also won as a player. He's probably, in history, he'll go down as the best basketball coach of all time. Mm.
And, of course, Auerbach was his coach in the distant history.
In the past, yes, yeah. He was. So I think in some ways you could say he was mentored by him. He also mentored himself. He's very much the Zen master, the master of the triangle offense. And what he said, Derek Fisher said yesterday, that he doesn't control his players. He empowers them to be who they really are.
Let's talk about the coverage for a moment. First of all, I don't want you to go anywhere, okay, because we really need you here on The Takeaway. But is there a way you could replace Magic Johnson? He was just impossible.
I think what you noticed was Magic Johnson literally feeling like he wanted to get back on the court again. And I think he quite hasn't realized that it's not going to happen.
Yeah, he really looks like he can too. Sort of a blimp Johnson there. And finally, you know, what did you make of the high tech features of the coverage? I mean, the fact that it was in HD, they had lots of different camera angles. It seems like the replay in the NBA is a whole new show.
I think they have amazing players on the court, and now you have this whole technological aspect where they can shift the game around and move the screen around. I think it's amazing. So you get guys like Ariza and Odom knocking down threes in the second half, and then you can show exactly how it broke down and how it happened.
So the Orlando Magic, they were defeated. They're a young team. Do they live and be a powerhouse in the East next season?
I think the Magic would hope so. I think the Magic, the team is a throwback team. They're a family-owned franchise. So I think they're going to keep their players in-house, and we'll see what happens. They're still going to have to contend with the Celtics and the Cavaliers. And then the Lakers are a young team as well.
And as you said, you were the one that coined the phrase, this is Disney World versus Disneyland. Disney World gets the bigger gate,
I think.
But it's all Disneyland after last night.
Definitely Disneyland all day long.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much. Takeaway sports blogger and contributor talking about the NBA Finals. Ibrahim, always a pleasure.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. And now Femi Okay has the headline.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, all. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah al-Khamenei is ordering an investigation.
Khamenei.
Thank you. I had an extra Ali in there. Delete that later. Thank you very much. So let me start that one more time.
Sure.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei is ordering an investigation after allegations of election fraud in the country's presidential election last
week. It's a huge reversal. It's a big story. Giant story.
Now, this comes according to Iran's state-run television. Mm. The results show that President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad actually won quite handily, but opposition candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi claims that... Stop staring at me, John. You're making me nervous. Stop staring at me and it will all go very, very right as opposed to going very wrong. So the main opposition candidate claims that there was widespread vote rigging, which President Ahmadinejad denies. Now, President Ahmadinejad has delayed a planned visit to Russia amid the dispute over his victory. Now, he'd been due to travel there today for a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and that's a regional security group. Heading back home to California, today's the deadline for the California state government to close the state's $24.3 billion budget deficit. Now, if lawmakers can't reach an agreement, the state may be forced to delay payments to local governing bodies and vendors until the end of July. In Washington, a U.S. district court will hold a hearing today on the health of the man suspected of fatally shooting a security guard at the Holocaust Memorial Museum. 88-year-old James von Brunn was shot after opening fire in the museum last week. FBI officials have said that he is likely to survive. And finally, ending on a sports story, as we've been talking sports for the last couple of minutes. Athletes compete to get into the Olympics and sports compete as well. Seven different sports are making their final presentations to the International Olympic Committee in Switzerland today to be included in the 2016 Games. Now, only two are expected to be chosen, but on the list we have baseball, softball, karate, golf, rugby, squash and roller sports.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And in Britain, it's been announced today that the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, will launch an inquiry into the Iraq War. Britain, of course, backed up the U.S. in Iraq during the invasion in 2003 and afterwards. It fought in Iraq and mainly was in charge of the southern territory around the city of Basra until recently. Joining us is BBC political correspondent and a former BBC Pentagon correspondent, Nick Childs. He joins us from London. Nick, how unprecedented is this for the government to call for an inquiry?
Well, it's been a long time coming, John. The opposition have been calling for it for a long time. The whole British involvement in Iraq was, of course, hugely controversial. And the opposition have said we really need to look into how Britain got into this and what happened in the conflict and its aftermath. Up to now, the government has said it would be wrong to do this while there are still British combat forces involved in combat operations. But that's all unravelling now. The formal end of the British combat role was announced in April. Most combat troops will be out next month. So that's one of the triggers for Gordon Brown standing up now to say, essentially, we will go ahead with this long called for inquiry.
Well, Nick Childs, from the perspective of the British public that's likely to be paying attention to this, what are they more interested in? The review of the tactics and behavior of British soldiers on the ground in Iraq, or how Tony Blair got led into this by George W. Bush in the begin with?
I think that's much, much more what people are really looking into. There have been any number of controversies around that. And, of course, the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, as you mentioned, sort of left under that the cloud of his relationship with George Bush. There have been attempts to get key cabinet meetings just ahead of the war when the discussions on the legality of the conflict were on the table, get them published. That hasn't happened. And a key element of what Gordon Brown is going to say this afternoon, essentially for most people, are the details of what is actually going to be discussed, who's going to head it all, when it's actually going to happen, and crucially, how much of it is going to be held in public and held in private.
Well, you raise the prospect that there are source materials that are available to British historians and political leaders that perhaps we wouldn't have available to us here in the United States of the workings of our own government in Washington. What's the likelihood that some juicy quotes and indications of the orientation of the Bush administration are going to come out in this look at Britain's role in the invasion?
Well, that's a minefield that Gordon Brown's going to have to tiptoe through, essentially. We have had an inquiry in the past that people are looking at as a model when the 1982 Falklands War happened. It was called the Franks Inquiry, headed by Lord Franks. That was held in private, essentially, with key individuals looking at the evidence in private. Now, people are saying that's not going to be good enough, and one of the opposition parties is saying, well, boycott this if it is held on those lines. But one of the problems that Gordon Brown is going to have to face, including from his own party, and part of the timing of this may be the fact that he's making a concession to his own party, because his leadership was very much in crisis a week or so ago, and he'd survived by the skin of his teeth. This may be a concession to people in his own party on this. The key point is how public can he make it, or is he going to have to take the consideration of the U.S. government and some of their secrecy issues into account?
Well, it's an interesting window, but I doubt it would have any real impact on Gordon Brown's own political troubles, but fascinating to contemplate, and we may be looking at it very soon. Nick Childs, BBC political correspondent, former BBC Pentagon correspondent. Thank you, Nick.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, a discussion of a difference of opinion among doctors about health care reform. We're asking you, in the meantime, if you were designing the perfect health insurance program, what would you cover?
Good morning. Troy calling from North Dakota. Massage should be covered under all health plans. I think it is under some. But if I could have a massage once or twice a month, I think it would add 20 years to my life.
Troy,
Did you hear the way he said massage?
He sounded like Troy. He was getting one.
We love Troy. What's covered in your plan at 877-8 My Take or MyTake at takeaway.org? Femi OK has the headline.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, President Obama hits the road to sell his health care plan today. He'll speak to the American Medical Association, a doctor's lobbying group. The AMA has criticized a White House interest in a government-run insurance program. Now, after the speech, President Obama returns to the White House to meet with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Italy hosts the G8 summit next month. In sports, the LA Lakers are the new NBA champs. They beat the Orlando Magic last night to win the NBA Finals 99-86. They won the championship series 4-1, and coach Phil Jackson won a record 10th NBA title. And finally, to Cuba, where the security around the Castro family has been breached in an intriguing way. Cuban exile and journalist Luis Dominguez posed as a Colombian female sports fan and began an online relationship with Fidel Castro's son, Antonio Castro. Our partners, the BBC, have dramatized some of their correspondence.
In Colombia, men are macho, and I don't like that. I spend so much time searching for information and reading.
Very good. You know, I don't see myself as macho.
Oh, tell me about yourself. Are you single?
Yes.
It's master. It's like classic theatre.
What is going on there?
So during their correspondence, Antonio, who's a doctor, gave out his mobile number. Also revealed he had a number of luxuries that obviously ordinary Cubans don't get to
Enterprising
have.
Enterprising reporting. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver specific plans to the White House today.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the health care system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their health care from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Thinking about health care. Congress is, the Obama administration is, and all of us are. Here on The Takeaway, you're calling us with your suggestions for perfect coverage. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Joining us this morning is Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, who is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard, co-director of the Harvard Medical School General Internal Medicine Fellowship Program, and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Doctor, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to be speaking to you on the day that Barack Obama is in Chicago to pitch his own reform agenda to the American Medical Association. But before we talk about what doctors' interests are in health care reform, or maybe not reforming health care at all, let's talk first of all about the curious and fragile relationship between people's health care and their economic and financial health, and how that bears directly on how the economy and healthcare go hand in hand.
We found that 62% of all personal bankruptcies are due to medical illness and medical bills. So many middle-class people who purchase private health insurance in good faith do find that when they get sick, the health insurance fails them. 78% of all families in medical bankruptcy had health insurance at the onset of the illness that bankrupted them, usually private insurance. I mean, we actually view private insurance as a defective product.
Now, this is a really interesting point, and everyone should really pay attention here, because even though statistics show that most people who have health coverage are happy with their coverage, or a majority, in fact, but what you're saying is that in actual practice, these coverages, these products tend to fail, and people are driven into bankruptcy and financial ruin.
Absolutely. When you have it on a piece of paper, and that's your relationship to your insurance plan, or maybe you had your pap smear or something, the insurance looks pretty good. But if you get a prolonged and expensive illness, you're really in trouble, and you may find yourself among the hundreds of thousands of U.S. families annually who are driven into bankruptcy. The problem with private insurance is for many people it's connected with their job, and they get too sick and they can't work, they lose their insurance. For other people in our study of medical bankruptcy, they hung on to private insurance throughout the illness that bankrupted them, but they were bankrupted anyway by gaps in coverage like co-payments, deductibles, and loopholes that let their insurance get out of paying for care.
Well, our mission here on The Takeaway, as we get into the real rough-and-tumble health care debate on Capitol Hill, is to give people different ways of thinking about the system that maybe they haven't heard of before. And this is a really important point. Now, President Obama is in Chicago to pitch his health care reform agenda to the American Medical Association, as I mentioned. Does the Obama plan address this issue of financial fragility?
Absolutely not. The Obama plan does nothing for people who already have health insurance. He may cover some of those who are uninsured, but at a tremendous cost, at a cost that's really not sustainable. If you leave the private health insurance industry in place and in charge of things the way this reform will, you're going to continue to have huge administrative waste. We've estimated in articles that we published in New England Journal of Medicine that 31%, nearly a third of all U.S. health spending goes to the paperwork costs associated with billing all these multiple insurers. Canada has overhead costs that are half of that on a per capita basis. If our health insurance system were as efficient administratively as that in Canada, we could save about $400 billion annually just on paperwork and use that money to cover the uninsured and to improve the coverage of people who now have this defective private insurance, and that would not raise health care costs. That's a sustainable plan. But what Obama is talking about is simply not affordable, not sustainable, and for that reason will not get us to real universal coverage.
Dr. Wohlhandler, let's talk for a minute about the constituency of doctors. Obama is going to talk to the AMA, but that's just one constituency. I don't want you to get to speak for all physicians here. Maybe it's unfair to make you do that, but with your insight as an academic and as a doctor, are there different constituencies in the medical profession and with different agendas for reform?
Absolutely. I mean, three-quarters of all U.S. physicians do not belong to the AMA. Three-quarters do not belong. Many of them belong to organizations such as American College of Physicians, which is the second largest physicians organization, which supports universal health care and has said that single payer would be one of the options to seriously consider. 15,000 U.S. physicians belong to my organization, Physicians for a National Health Program, and we're a single-issue organization. All we do is advocate for nonprofit national health insurance for the United States, also known as single-payer and also known as Medicare for All.
Very quickly before we go, if a doctor stands up and makes a lot of noise against a single-payer national health care program, is that doctor more likely to be a specialist or more likely to be an, a primary care physician?
Well, that doctor's more likely to be very business-oriented. The AMA has led a group of American physicians who are very business-oriented and are protecting the economic interests of doctors, which is fair. Labor unions do that for other people. It's fair in a way. But what our organization has said is that doctors actually need to speak for their patients. And this is not just about protecting doctors. This is about protecting the health of the American people. We tend to be a little stronger in primary care. Our point of view supporting national health insurance is stronger among primary care doctors, stronger among psychiatrists. But a recent poll by the University of Indiana found that a majority of all U.S. physicians support nonprofit national health insurance. So the AMA is actually not speaking for the majority at this point.
Well, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what tone President Obama takes when he speaks with the AMA in Chicago later today. Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Wohlhandler is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard. One doctor voice there. Her organization is Physicians for a National Health Program. We're asking you, if you were designing a health insurance program, what would you cover?
This is Mike from Wayne, New Jersey, concerning what should be added to a health care plan. How about that we add nothing? Matter of fact, let's just stick to the bare essentials to make sure that we have coverage for the most serious tests and procedures. And maybe everybody else just pays cash for the smaller things.
You know how to weigh in, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
If you have a youth movement that supports the opposition, that could in fact become an underground, that even if the Ayatollahs come out and say that they support this election result of Ahmadinejad coming back to office, could create a kind of underground, underlying problem for years to come for this regime.
It's our friend, the New York Times' Marcus Mabry, talking about the aftermath of Iran's election over the weekend. If you go to our website, you can learn about your water footprint and also sign up for our podcast to hear anything on the program, because we are always on. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Massage.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Landslide. The smiling hardliner Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declares victory.
This sets a record by itself, a great record in the whole of the world. They chose the path to the future, the path of dignity and pride.
Well, I've been afraid of changing, 'cause I've built my life around you.
Our people, with full vigilance, made their choice, a great choice.
But time made you bolder, even children get older now.
Iran's Islamic Revolution gets older. Young people on the streets of Tehran get bolder. Landslide on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, June 15th. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we'll have a conversation on everything you need to know about the implications of that landslide in Iran. It may actually be unfolding. President Obama is going to heat up the healthcare debate today with a major speech to doctors. Todd Zwillick will set the table for us, and later we'll talk to a congressman who's also a doctor for his take on the issue of healthcare. All this and much more ahead, but first we've got your latest headlines. And in the headlines, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is launching an investigation into fraud claims in last week's presidential election. Riots broke out this weekend after election officials declared incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad the winner. The protests continue today. We also have reports that President Ahmadinejad is delaying a planned visit to Russia because of the unrest, presumably. As we mentioned, President Obama hits the road to sell his health care plan today. He'll speak to the American Medical Association, a lobbying group for some doctors. The AMA has criticized White House interest in a government-run insurance program. And later today, the president meets with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi on quite another matter. That meeting comes in advance of the Group of Eight economic summit hosted by Italy in July. Staying with the news from the White House, President Obama calls a new speech by Israel's prime minister an important step forward. Benjamin Netanyahu endorsed a Palestinian state for the first time yesterday, but he also refused to heed a U.S. call to immediately freeze settlement construction. Art Hughes is a former ambassador to several Mideast countries. He says the speech is a start.
I think it's useful. I think it might even be important. I don't consider it a real concession, but I'm glad he said it. That just allows the process to move on to the next steps.
A discussion of those next steps coming up. Femi, okay, take us out on the headlines, will you?
I certainly will. New numbers on gas prices are out, and they show that prices are spiking 17 cents in the last 2 weeks. The Lomberg survey says that the average price of regular gas is now $2.66 a gallon. Turning to sports, basketball has a new champion this morning. The LA Lakers beat the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals last night, 99-86, and they won the championship series 4-1.
John. Good news for LA. The S&P starts trading at 946. The Dow begins at 87.99. Futures trading suggests a negative opening. We're talking about healthcare this morning, and we want you to add to the list of what should be covered in a perfect healthcare plan. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. So, an election result in Iran, protesters on the streets of Tehran, and all of a sudden questions and possibly complications for the Obama administration in Washington. You could say the same about what happened over the weekend in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu delivers a speech on policy and possibly complications again for the Obama administration, hoping to move forward on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Joining us now, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. He joins us from Washington. David, thanks for being with us, as always.
Good to be back with you.
And welcoming back to the program, Aaron David Miller, former advisor on the Middle East and the author of The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. He also joins us from the nation's capital. Aaron David Miller, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me remind our listeners a couple of things that have happened really overnight. You've got Ahmadinejad winning the election in Iran, yet protesters on the street. You had the speech yesterday of Benjamin Netanyahu, who took a step towards a full embrace of a two-state solution, which was news. Barack Obama called that a step forward, yet he signaled inflexibility on the settlements issue and suggested that final status talks on a Palestinian right of return and the capital of Jerusalem, there would be no flexibility on those issues. David Sanger, suddenly do we have two potentially weak political hardliners in Barack Obama's path, in Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, certainly in the case of Iran, the question is, do you have a weak hardliner or do you have a hardliner who's been restored by the true power behind the scenes in Iran? You know, the big question in Iran is who's running the place, and thus who do you negotiate with? And what I find interesting, John, is that, you know, if you just go back a few months, there was a whole strain of thinking in the American intelligence community, among other places, that Ahmadinejad had become an embarrassment, that his denials of the Holocaust were ridiculous, that his management of the economy was disastrous, and therefore that perhaps the leadership of Iran would try to get rid of him and use the electoral process to bring in somebody less confrontational but more pliable. And, in fact, that's not what happened.
Right, indeed. Aaron David Miller, on the Benjamin Netanyahu speech yesterday, you've described it as kind of a placeholder, nothing terribly newsworthy. Yet, I'm wondering if this morning, if you're in the White House, your interest is in strengthening Benjamin Netanyahu to move forward or in weakening him politically to move forward and maybe thinking beyond Benjamin Netanyahu.
I don't think that question has been answered yet. I think the administration is making a virtue out of necessity by welcoming what was clearly at least a difficult ideological journey on the part of the prime minister. I mean, the Obama administration, I think, understands that the history of peacemaking in Israel has always been a history of the right wing, whether it's Begin or Rabin, who is a transformed hawk. It's hawks walking the walk, not doves talking the talk. The issue is not that you've got a right-wing Israeli government. The issue is that you've got a divided Israeli government and no consensus on the part of that government or the people of Israel about what price the Israelis are prepared to pay right now for a conflict-ending agreement with the Palestinians. So both of these situations, Tehran and Jerusalem, really constitute, it seems to me, major headaches in the administration's efforts to create a greater amount of peace and stability in this very dysfunctional region.
Well, Aaron David Miller, let me get your response to this question, and I also want to hear what David Sanger has to say. But do you think that Netanyahu's speech yesterday removes the momentum that seemed to be there with the Saudi plan, which calls for a possible recognition of Israel if there is an agreement on the part of Israel to at least approach some of these final status issues? Is that momentum now gone?
I'm not sure there was much momentum to begin with. I mean, Americans love, myself included, to convince themselves that they hold the keys, and by speaking and by asserting, by appointing envoys, somehow we can affect the calculations of smaller tribes. We can, when those smaller tribes, in effect, have a will, and determination, either out of the prospects of gain or pain, to move forward. That situation does not exist in this current environment.
Right.
This Netanyahu speech was not about the Arab-Israeli peace process. It was about the U.S.-Israeli process, and it represents a kind of round two in the ongoing test of wills between what I call President Yes We Can squaring off against Prime Minister No You Won't.
And that's a great way of framing it. David Sanger, I mean, is this a possible misread by the sort of giddy, hey, we won the world, the Obama administration White House sort of coming in thinking that it can just basically tweak the world into a peaceful situation? They misread Iran, and maybe they've misread the situation in Israel?
Well, you know, we all knew that there was going to come some moment when the magic of the enthusiasm about the election of President Obama around the world would wear off, and what I had referred to as the inheritance from President Bush simply becomes the day-to-day management problems of President Obama. And I think that this weekend we sort of hit one of those corners in the road out here, that at this point President Ahmadinejad becomes, it's clear, the one who President Obama is going to have to deal with for the next 4 years. And in the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu, while it's not at all clear he'll be dealing with him for 4 years, President Obama now has to deal with the interrelated problems. One, that the United States has now made it clear that the expansion of the settlements is not something that President Obama is going to sit back and take the way President Bush did, the natural growth. And secondly, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is now going to be using the election in Iran to test the United States on Israel's patience in sitting back and waiting for engagement to work.
Right.
Remember, it was just a year ago that the Israelis wanted to get the equipment to take out the Natanz nuclear site. I suspect now they'll be coming back and saying, see, we told you who you were dealing with here, so you don't have many months to make this engagement work.
Clearly, the Ahmadinejad result over the weekend in Iran is a very strong, strengthening argument for Netanyahu to stay where he is and not move anywhere. Aaron David Miller, let's look at the sort of apparatus that the Obama administration has set up here. You've got Barack Obama giving his speech in Cairo. You've got Hillary Clinton making her whirlwind tour of the region. You've got George Mitchell in Damascus right now. Okay, so there's inflexibility in Jerusalem. Can you parry with some sort of development out of Syria that might deliver some sort of momentum to the process by a side deal with Damascus at this point? What's your assessment of George Mitchell's mission right now?
You know, I used to think so, because on paper, the Israeli-Syrian agreement is much, much easier. Much, much easier. But I'm not sure anymore. I think the administration has so invested in the Israeli-Palestinian track, so gotten itself out on a limb on the issue of natural growth and settlements, so publicly orchestrated its policies in Cairo, that the shift gears and somehow go to the Israeli-Syrian negotiation is simply not going to fly. I think the reality is, and you know, David Sanger in his excellent book talks about the inheritance, this is a world in which we live that's to be managed, not to be resolved. Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, the Arab-Israeli issue, and now the even more complex situation in Iran. The administration has created an empire of envoys to deal with this problem.
You know, Sanger,
maybe
somebody...
that'll work, maybe it won't, but it's, you know, in the Middle East, there are two speeds. There's long and there's longer.
Right.
And I think the administration is understanding that now and is going to have to figure out what does it want to do with respect to the Israelis. You know, fighting with the Israelis makes sense, but not because you're frustrated with them, and certainly not because you're frustrated or want to make nice to the Arabs. Fighting with the Israelis makes sense if you can actually achieve a breakthrough in negotiations that makes the president look good and serves the interest, not only American interests, but the interests of Arab and Israeli peace. And we're way, way, way away from that.
If somebody plugs your book anymore, David Sanger, I'm going to have to invoice you, you know.
Well, that's right.
That's
you know, Aaron and I had had offices down the hall from each other at the Woodrow Wilson Center, where he is, as we were working on our respective books. So it's part of a side deal.
I see. It's great. Well, yeah. Very, very well done. Very quickly, David Sanger, does the administration now, are they under pressure to confront Ahmadinejad and do what the Bush administration did, really inflate his power, or do we back away at this point? We really just have a few seconds.
I think what you're going to see happen is they're going to go back to Plan A, which is that President Obama said, we're going to give this to the end of the year to assess where engagement goes, because there's one theory under which a stronger reelected President Ahmadinejad can now attempt an opening with the U.S. We don't know that's going to happen.
David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times, and Aaron David Miller, former advisor on the Middle East. Thanks to both of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Barack Obama will get an earful from doctors when he goes to Chicago to talk to the AMA about health care. If you were designing the perfect health care plan for yourself, what's covered?
My name is John Howard from Melrose, Massachusetts. My suggestion strongly would be anything to do with stress control, stress management. Right now, 43% of all diseases and illnesses is stress-related.
How about a yoga class? Losing weight, mental health care, what needs coverage in your life? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So if you were watching the NBA Finals last night and you looked carefully courtside, you could see get your tickets for the WNBA at WNBA.com. The boys get out of the way as the finals end at the NBA, and the women's season begins. Here to talk about what to look for in the WNBA is the writer for ESPN.com, Michelle Vopel. She joins us from Kansas City, Missouri, from radio station KCUR. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
First of all, if you're fans of the Orlando Magic, and they didn't comport themselves very well last night, you're going to really like the style of game that is played by the women. It's more a team sport. It's focused on team shooting percentages and maybe a little less focused on the star style of play that the Lakers exhibited last night.
Yeah, I think obviously with the NBA, you're looking at, I think, the best athletes in the world at anything. And just the individual skill level, the things they're able to do. The body sizes obviously are quite different with the women. So the style the women play still, while it can be quite spectacular, actually, is more dependent on a team game. It's more dependent on running your plays. And also the women fit on the court a little bit more like basketball used to be. You don't have the gargantuan sizes. And so the court size, I think, and the skill level of the women make the team game something that that works very well for them.
In theory, it should make it more accessible to the fans. But fans this year coming to WNBA games are going to see fewer players on the roster. They're not going to see the Houston Comets, who won the first four championships because of economic reasons. That franchise is gone. They're also going to see higher visibility corporate branding on certain uniforms. Is there a sense of economic desperation in the WNBA this season?
I think there's a sense of economic desperation in the whole world
I've noticed.
It's hitting sports leagues the same way that it's hitting everything else. I don't know that this is necessarily there's necessarily any signs that we've seen early on from this season that are especially negative. I mean, the fact that two of the teams have jersey sponsors now is, to me, is good news for the league. Loss of the Comets was a really difficult thing for the league to go through. This is a four-time champion and one of the inaugural franchises. But this is what happens in professional sports. If you can't survive, you're not going to be propped up for that long. And the WNBA wasn't going to keep that franchise there if they couldn't find a local buyer, and they couldn't. With all sports leagues, you're going to have economic difficulties in different regions of the country that can affect the longevity of franchises. And in a league like the WNBA, which is still establishing itself, it's in its 13th season, but it's still, I say it's right now, it's kind of a gawky adolescent, right, in terms of the sports entertainment market. And yep, every year, we go through some, and we're used to that. And when anybody who's involved in women's sports, there are specific growing pains because it's women, and it's a more limited audience for a variety of reasons. But, the league is still here after 13 years, and the fact that it is still going, in some ways, it's like, what is it, showing up is 75% of life. Well, they're still showing up.
No, it's a great achievement. And let's talk about the faces, the talents, the teams that are going to be the narrative of this season, as you can see it going forward.
Well, it's interesting because, just a week ago when the season started, most of us who follow the league and think we know what we're talking about would have said that Los Angeles was the favorite for the WNBA title, team loaded with talent. Right now they're struggling. They're at the bottom of the Western Conference. And we've seen some surprises. A team like Minnesota that has a lot of young players, players that maybe people are becoming more familiar with just because they had visibility during the NCAA tournament in their college careers. That team surprised a lot of people. Same way in the Eastern Conference. There's been some surprising results in the first week. And I think one of the things, the downside of the rosters being smaller, being 11 players instead of 13, obviously is there are fewer jobs, and that is definitely a reflection of economics. The upside, because you always want to look at the bright side, is the teams are incredibly talented. You have to be very good to make a team in this league, and so the parity in the league is very strong.
What do you think it's going to take in either the style of play or the kind of emergence of personalities that's going to bring young girls to really focusing on the WNBA as fans, as kind of obsessive fans, as happens with the NBA, the men's game?
I think the progression of something being around. I'm 44 years old, and I grew up loving the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team. It had been around when my dad was a little boy. He grew up with it. Then I grew up with it. He passed that down to me, and it's something I've had all my life. People always talk about sports teams being the one thing that doesn't change. Everybody and everything else might leave you, but you still have your team. And that's why I think it's so important to have a women's sports league. We've had the LPGA and the Women's Professional Tennis Tour, but those aren't teams. Those are individual sports where players pass through. You can have a favorite player, but her time is going to pass by, and she's going to retire. With a team, you can have that association with it. You can have that kind of love of your team your whole life, and I think it's really necessary to have that for girls, have that thing that they can relate to.
At age 13, the WNBA is in that zone where it starts to pass from mother to daughter, that orientation with the team and the idea that you pass a fan identity from one generation to the next. Michelle Vopel, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Michelle Vopel is a WNBA writer for ESPN.com. She's covering the opening season, or the beginning of the season of the WNBA for us. And Femi Oke has our headlines. Good morning, Fem.
Good morning, everybody. Taking a look at some of the top stories from this morning, Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei is ordering an investigation after allegations of election fraud in the country's presidential election. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner, but his main opposition candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi, is calling for the results to be annulled. And while all of this has been happening in the last 24 hours or so, thousands of Iranians have staged a pro-Mousavi rally defying a government ban on protests. Mousavi said that he would attend and urged calm. And finally, President Obama visits Chicago today to sell his health care plan. He'll go to Chicago to address the American Medical Association, a lobbying group for some doctors. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Healthcare is on the agenda in Washington. If you were designing the perfect healthcare plan for yourself, what would be covered?
My name's Rebecca from Brooklyn, New York. I think physical therapy should be covered. Some of my plans don't include it unless I have surgery or an accident, and this means that I have to be injured to get help, but I'd like physical therapy to be covered preventatively.
What should be covered? What should be retail in healthcare? What needs coverage in your life? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, they're down in the details in Washington, and Barack Obama will be speaking with the American Medical Association, which represents a minority of doctors. He'll be going to Chicago to talk to these doctors who may be lobbying for one or another outcome in the healthcare debate, but certainly what is clear is that Congress, the House, and the Senate will suddenly be getting down to details, and we will know more about the outlines of plans that are going to make their way from the House and Senate, possibly to Barack Obama's desk, if they get that far. Joining us to possibly give some context to this process right at the beginning is Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, joins us from Washington. Todd, good morning.
Morning, John.
Now, there's an enormous task here. I mean, they have to outline the architecture of a funding plan for this, and it's really expensive. I mean, $1 trillion. I've seen that number batted around. They also have to give us the outlines of what coverage means, what a reformed coverage regime is going to actually look like. How much do we know?
Well, we don't know a lot yet. One of the drafts of one of the important bills came out at the beginning of last week. But guess what? They left all that stuff you just mentioned, they left it out because those are the tough questions to answer and the most controversial. And a lot of the leading Democrats in Congress have been saying, look, we're getting a lot of pushback from Republicans on the idea of a public plan. You've heard a lot about the president wants a public plan to, quote, keep the private health insurance industry honest, to compete with them. They might mandate that people have insurance either through their employer or individually or a mixture of both. And they get a lot of pushback. Republicans are not interested. So leading Democrats in Congress have been saying, Mr. President, we need you to be more vocal about this. We need you out on the road making the case not only to the important industries, i.e., the doctors, but also to the public. The president was in Michigan last week, I believe. He's in Chicago today. So you see the president taking up the reins here and going out and using that bully pulpit to try to push for the plan, get the public on board. You know, the one statistic, John, that overhangs this all the time, there are two. One is that nearly 50 million Americans don't have health insurance. We know that.
Right.
The other is that most Americans do have health insurance, and about 80% of them like what they have. Now, that doesn't mean it's good for public policy, those plans, but they like what they have, which means they don't want to lose it, which means the president, if he wants to change the way things are done, he has a pretty heavy lift. So this week is, I look at it as sort of the beginning of the lift. You know, in Olympic weightlifting, they have the clean and jerk. This is the clean, and the jerk comes later, the squat and the thrust. However you want to look at it, this is the first move.
You're calling the president a jerk? You're calling the president a jerk?
No, I'm saying he's got to jerk a lot of weight over his head. I'll say that.
Ooh, Todd Zwillick saving himself there. So let's talk about the AMA, though. He's talking to an organization which represents a minority of doctors.
That's
Are doctors a partner in this reform movement on healthcare?
He certainly needs them to be, because the AMA helped kill health reform back in 93, and the president knows it, and everyone knows it. The AMA and the insurance industry are almost eternal foes, but they weren't back in 93 because they both hated Clinton health reform, and they teamed up to kill it. So you're right. They only represent a minority of doctors. Only about less than 20% of doctors are members of the AMA. But the AMA is still a big contributor. I looked up $1.5 million in contributions in the 2008 election cycle, and that's just from AMA's PAC on the national level. The state medical societies give money, and don't forget about those individual hundreds of thousands of individual doctors with their relatively deep pockets. So it's not only their money. Doctors have daily contact with lots and lots of people in their communities, and people listen to their doctors about their opinions about what needs to be done for reform or what shouldn't be done. So they're very important as a political conduit. They're very important as a funding source, and they still have the AMA still has major clout in Washington.
All right, finally, Todd, we all remember what happened in 1994. The Clintons really sort of botched the health care reform program by kind of creating these committees and trying to sort of roll something through Congress. The Republicans decided to kill it, and that's where it stood. It seems to me this time around, it's much more likely that the Republicans are under some pressure to go along with something, but it may end up being so watered down that it actually doesn't constitute reform. What is the chance we're heading in that direction?
Well, that all remains to be seen. That's a fear that some Democrats have, and I think that's why you see a lot of people on the liberal end of the Democratic Party pushing for big things, like a big public plan, even something really close to what you might call socialized medicine. I think that they know, and we all know, that they're not going to get that. But you start off with the strongest bargaining position you can. So the left is more powerful in Congress than they used to be. Nancy Pelosi has said a health care reform bill will not get out of the House without a large public plan. I think she knows that that's a non-starter in the Senate, so they'll wind up someplace in the middle. One of the important things that's happening this week in the Senate is we'll start to find out the outlines of what a public plan means. And there are some centrist Democrats, this is important, who are proposing a kind of a co-op to bring Republicans on board. Not a big public plan, not totally run by the private sector, some kind of hybrid that's funded by the federal government or started or chartered by the federal government, but private insurance still has control. And that'll help bring people along. You see the outlines of a compromise starting to happen there.
Well, the competing plans, we're going to be taking a look at them all week long, really for the next month or so. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Thanks, Todd.
My pleasure.
And Wall Street's open with a headache. The Dow's down about 115 points. And Femi Okeh has the rest of the headlines.
Thank you very much. Thousands of supporters of opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi are taking part in protests in Tehran today. It's the largest display of opposition unity since Friday's election, in which the incumbent president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner. Mousavi says that the vote was rigged. Our partners, the BBC, are reporting that he's actually at the march. And the march comes just a few hours after Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, ordered an examination into the claims of vote rigging. There's been no sign of violence or challenges from security forces yet. I will keep you up to date with that rally. Here in the United States, the president has made a quick trip to his hometown of Chicago. The trip is to push his health care plan to the American Medical Association. And following on from that, he'll be back in Washington to meet with the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, and they will discuss the G8 summit Italy is hosting next month. There's a hearing coming today in the case of the recent killing at Washington's Holocaust Museum. A court will focus on the health of suspect James von Brunn in order to determine when his initial court appearance will be. He's charged with first-degree murder in the shooting death of a security guard. And that is a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And so the pictures continue from Tehran and from Iran, a tense weekend in that country, as the government cracked down on protests against the now disputed results of Friday's election. Supporters of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad conducted counter-protests in support of the incumbent. Riot police used tear gas, rubber bullets, stun grenades to subdue protesters, and the pictures were available to all the world, and much of the world is watching, to look at the implications of these disputed elections and to determine what is going to be the future for Mir Hossein Mousavi, who is the opposition candidate who went down in the election but certainly has a profile today. I'm joined by Afshin Malavi, senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author of Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom. First of all, Afshin, welcome back to the program. And secondly, what now for Mousavi?
Well, it seems that, as you reported, Mousavi is taking part in a peaceful protest, a march across Tehran. I think, John, so much of what we're seeing right now is unprecedented. The nature of these elections were unprecedented. The televised debates were unprecedented. The vote numbers. And we've never seen these kind of disputes to election results like this. So, in a sense, the question is, will Mousavi be an Iranian Boris Yeltsin, standing atop a tank, or will he be a Mohammad Khatami, the former reform-minded president who essentially backed down when students and others went out onto the streets in support of him, and he told them to pull back? And that's really the question we're facing right now.
You know, some analysts over the weekend were perhaps prematurely suggesting that Ahmadinejad's victory was a sign that a very long-standing dispute between secular politicians in Iran, as evidenced by Rafsanjani, a former prime minister, former president of Iran, and the clergy, as led by Ayatollah Khatami or Ayatollah Khamenei, that this battle was now over in favor of the clergy. What would you say based on what we've already been seeing this morning?
You know, I would actually say the battle lines are drawn between two generations of Iran's revolutionary elite. And the first generation of the revolutionary elite, many of whom are members of the clergy, and the second generation, many of whom hail from the security and intelligence services background, of which Ahmadinejad is a part of that group. And so what we're seeing really right now is a classic, revolution, post-revolution sort of 30 years later, when the revolutionaries are going at each other, and it is we're seeing some complex fissures. It's not only about mullahs versus secularists. It's not reformers versus conservatives. We're seeing some very interesting coalitions form. And John, I can tell you right now, there's a lot of backroom politicking taking place in Tehran.
Well, rather than speculate on backroom politicking, you're a young Iranian yourself. Mm-hmm. What's a young person in Tehran to do this morning as he or she rubs their eyes and thinks about the future? Quickly.
Absolutely. I think they will have to make a choice. Do they go out onto the streets, as one young Iranian told me, potentially face the batons, potentially face beatings, or do they stay at home? And that's never an easy choice to make. Wow. And so I think it remains to be seen what will happen there.
A lot at stake, but you put it very, very well. Afshin Malavi, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, the author of Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom, through the eyes of a young Iranian, what to do today? Join the protests or stay home.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, a discussion with a U.S. representative who is also a doctor, Steve Kagan from Wisconsin, joins us to talk about health care reform. But if you were designing an insurance plan, what would you cover?
My name is Brett, and I'm from Royal Oak, Michigan, and I would like to see a more preventative and holistic approach. My family and I, my son's 10 years old, and we've been using holistic living for over 10 years, and we have never seen a medical doctor during that time.
What needs coverage in your life at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we say a final good morning to Femi Okeh with an update of the headlines. Femi?
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Thanks, John. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been speaking on NBC's Today show this morning. His appearance follows a speech where he endorsed a Palestinian state for the first time. Prime Minister Netanyahu says that he has a vision of a separate Jewish and Palestinian state living side by side in harmony. But some Palestinian leaders are downplaying Netanyahu's speech, saying that he has too many conditions. NASA is fixing a leaky gas line on the space shuttle Endeavour in hopes of launching the shuttle on Wednesday. Now, if that happens, that would be 4 days after the first try was called off. And forecasters say that there's a 70% chance of good weather for the launch. Gas prices are up 17 cents in the last 2 weeks. The Lomberg survey says the average price of regular gas is now $2.66 a gallon. And finally, in sports, the International Tennis Federation is considering introducing a new rule to stop tennis players from loud grunting during play. Now, this could cause problems for players like Portuguese Michel Lacho de Brito. Here she is playing at the French Open earlier this year.
High-pitched grunting there.
Very high-pitched grunting.
High-pitched grunting,
I'm
yes.
exhausted just listening to it. Yeah. The new ban could be included in the code of conduct and probably won't refer to grunting, but to noise hindrance rather
it's
than grunting.
It's irresponsible of you not to have talked to any pro-grunting supporters for that story, Femi.
I have some anti-grunters, but not pro-grunters.
Yeah, no pro-grunters. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver specific plans to the White House today.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their health care from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
A maverick joins us now as we continue our discussion of health care reform. Congressman Stephen Kagan, a Democrat representing Wisconsin. He's also a medical doctor, and he joins us from Appleton, Wisconsin. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you this morning.
Now, you have refused to be insured under the federal plan, the very generous federal plan that federal employees, including members of Congress, get until there is affordable health care for all. I mean, let's just say at the top, as laudable as that may be, it's something that is not going to really hurt you personally, right?
Well, it just isn't true. If you don't have health insurance today, you don't have the coverage you need. And you go to bed every night, as I do, wondering if this is the night I'm going to lose everything I've got. I went to Congress not to get benefits, but to guarantee that everybody and all of my patients have access to affordable care.
But
care
unlike,
that they
unlike,
so badly require.
Right, but unlike the 50 million Americans who don't have health care, you are in a position to afford whatever sort of health problems that you might get yourself into, right?
Well, I don't think you want to talk about me. You want to talk about people. If we're talking about reforming our health care system, it's really all about people. So any solution that Congress comes up with has to begin with that understanding. And currently, Congress is putting forward a number of ideas to accomplish just that. I met with President Obama several days ago when he traveled to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and he shares my opinion. I like his approach. He's got the three C's. He wants everyone in this country to have choices. He wants everyone to have the care that they need at a cost they can afford.
All right. Let's talk specifically about what the president's going to be doing today. He's going to be talking with other doctors, members of the American Medical Association. Are you a member of the AMA?
I was. And I think I still am.
All right. Some have said that the AMA represents a minority of business-oriented doctors who have a greater degree of influence than the numbers would suggest. What's the AMA's interest in health care reform, do you think?
I'm not an expert on the AMA, but I'm an expert on my district. I represent nearly 700,000 people, and everybody here is saying the same thing. The number one issue on their mind is the high cost of health care. It is the number one cause of bankruptcy in our 8th Congressional District. Every business, if you're a small business, a large business, all city governments and state governments, federal governments, the number one overhead cost is health care. So I agree with our president that the number one fiscal challenge we're facing is the high cost of health care. And I think when we start with two things, we can drive down costs for everybody. The first thing that President Obama has accepted is that there should be no discrimination against any citizen or legal resident due to a pre-existing medical condition. And I don't think you really understand what that means. When that is fully implicated across the country, when you apply that right, that civil right that guarantees you will not suffer from discrimination, when you go to the pharmacy, you'll be able to pay the lowest price that they accept as full payment from anybody. And that price will be openly disclosed. There'll be no more discrimination at the pharmacy, at the hospital, or at the doctor's office.
All right, that's nice, but it doesn't necessarily address the issue that you raised a moment ago, and that is people's financial fragility as a result of health care. Why is it that the Physicians for a National Health Program say that the Obama administration's plan, which you say you endorse, doesn't affect this issue of medical-related bankruptcies, that most people, even if they have health insurance, are likely to go bankrupt if they get sick?
Well, if you want to get their opinion, you should be talking to them.
I did talk to them.
Well, that's great. I don't know what their opinion is. I know the opinion of my district.
Congressman, hold on. Congressman, sure. I asked you a very specific question. The Obama plan does not address the bankruptcy question, which you raised in this conversation. Do you think the Obama plan affects the fragility of people who are likely to become bankrupt if they get sick under the current system?
Well, I don't know that you've read the Obama plan, but he has highlighted specific things: choice, care that gets you the coverage that you need, and cost reduction. That's it. It's not in fine print. That's going to be done in Congress, and that's being done right now.
All right,
and the final piece of legislation has not been written.
Understood.
But there have to be two elements, as I mentioned. You allowed me to say the first one, right?
Okay.
No discrimination. Now, I gather that you're all in favor of that idea of no discrimination. Everybody I talk to accepts it. They don't want to be discriminated against, and they don't want to pay the highest price. They want to pay the lowest price. The second thing we have to do in this country, you know, we have federal standards for everything in this country, whether it's manufacturing or standards for automobiles, standards on your radio show.
Congressman, with all due respect,
health benefit plan.
Let's just not run out the clock here. How would the Obama plan and your plan keep people from going into bankruptcy if they get sick? That's a very simple question.
It would drive down costs, and I've identified nearly $790 billion of cost reductions in hospital care and efficiencies within private insurance. When insurance companies are compelled to sell the same piece of paper, the same standardized, federally standardized health benefit plan, we can begin to drive down costs. Now, you know, there is no marketplace in health care. The price at the hospital is whatever they can get. There is no transparency. I'd like you to be able to go to the hospital or call them up or Google a pharmacy and find out the price of the medication you need so you can get the medication you need at a price you can afford to pay.
Right, but under the current system, even if you do Google the healthcare system, virtually all the options, if you get seriously ill, are going to drive you into bankruptcy. Is there a federal guarantee of coverage that will keep people from going bankrupt?
Well, our country is bankrupt right now. We can't afford what we're doing, whether it's going to be overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Congressman, that frustrates me because you're really not answering the question. You're just talking about Afghanistan now. Americans are serious about health care. That is a dodge.
Well, the answer to your question is our country is broke. We can't afford Medicare. We can't afford Medicaid. Medicare and Medicaid oftentimes don't even cover the overhead cost of caring. So when a doctor sees you if you're on Medicare and doesn't have the overhead met, they have to cost shift to somebody else who's paying. That's why you're paying more for health care, due to cost shifting. And I don't understand why you wouldn't be in favor of competition, of a free market system.
I want to find out what the plan will be and what the system will be. I'm all in favor of this debate on Capitol Hill, and we're going to have to leave it there. But Congressman Stephen Kagan, thanks so much for joining us. As we mentioned, he has refused federal health care until there is an affordable health care system for all. He has a vote in Congress because he's the Democratic congressman from Appleton, Wisconsin. Stephen Kagan joined us from Wisconsin. Thank you very much, Congressman.
Have a great day.
So what would be in your perfect health insurance plan?
Hi, my name is Phoebe from Brooklyn. I think home birth should be covered. It is a safe and cheap alternative to medicalized birth.
Tell us your take at our website, thetakeaway.org. You can also call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And while you're there, you can get more of a sports fix from our sports correspondent, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He reviews Kobe Bryant's trip to, guess what, Disneyland on thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Monday, folks. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James O. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.